Welcome back, everybody, to the Talking Sportsbooks podcast. And coming up in this edition on the eve of the new Formula One season, what better time to explore its history with motor racing journalist Tony Dodgins, who spent his life covering the sport, attending every Grand Prix for multiple outlets and publications over the last three decades. Now, he has put together one of those impressive coffee table-sized books titled Formula One, The Legends, The Cult Drivers and Their Legacies. Now, the book mixes editorial with an immersive collection of great photography that charts the rise and fall of the sports legends. Also, boxing features today as well. Pete Carvel has just released the book Death of a Boxer. Now, this is no open love letter to the sport. In fact, there is no glamour here whatsoever, really. It's rather a selection of stories and interviews that highlight the sport's brutality and danger, whilst acknowledging a degree of redemptiveness for some who crave a direction in their life. Don't forget, you can listen to every episode of this program either on the website, www.talkingsportsbooks.com, or via any streaming provider. And if you want to join in the discussion, this is new, anything to do with books and sport, there is a new Facebook page. It is called Sports Books and Literature, where you can comment, post, and generally discuss anything to do with sport and literature. And I literally just put this together over the last 12 hours or so. So it is there. And if you want to join in, that is where you can go. And so let's start with the F1, the legends, cult drivers and their legacies. As we said, Tony Dodgins has been covering this sport over the last three decades, going to pretty much every Grand Prix that has been on. And he has put out this book, which looks at the history of the motor racing greats right from the very start. Now, this book, as we said, mixes not just editorial, but the photography is very, very impressive. There's some great pictures in here. Now, I spoke to Tony a couple of days ago about a selection of some of these cult heroes. Of course, the only problem with a book like this is there are so many cult heroes and so many great legacies. Whose do you choose? Well, listen on and you'll find out. I wanted to start by saying that the sport of F1 lends itself perfectly to books like this. You know, just sitting, thumbing through the pages and poring in particular over the photography. It sort of transports you back in time to this sort of golden era, you know, the glamour, the danger, the ultimate sacrifice, and of course the thrill of winning.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in the early days, there was very much a feeling that, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the Formula One World Championship started sort of 5 years after the end of the Second World War, you know, when, you know, life was kind of cheap and, you know, there might have been Spitfire pilots or that kind of ilk, you know, it was very much that kind of a feeling.
Yeah, and let's not forget, by the way, that when it did start 5 years after the Second World War, in attendance was royalty at the Silverstone Grand Prix. King Edward, wasn't it? And, of course, latter-day Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all kicked off, obviously, at Silverstone as well, the first World Championship race. And you can't hardly believe we've had sort of 73 years of the Formula One World Championship. But the number of sort of legendary figures in that time, you know, from Fangio right through to now we've got the Hamiltons and Verstappens, they're still massively interesting individuals.
You know, it might not be politically correct, but I was thinking as I was looking through this, we should allow tobacco and alcohol ads back on the cars, because I thought that they definitely lost something. I mean, whoever in the time since it first appeared has ever bettered the look of the black and gold John Player Special, or even the Marlboro McLaren or Martini Rosso being emblazoned across the sides of the cars.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that JPS Lotus 72, you go back to, well, in fact, even in the gold leaf colours from, 69-70, when they first, it was sort of Chapman who first, the Lotus boss who first, really brought commercial sponsorship hugely into Formula One. And it was gold leaf at first. And that Lotus 72 that Jochen Rindt won the world championship with in 1970, the sports only posthumous world champion. I think that car looked fantastic as well. But I think probably you're right. When it was black and gold and you had, the Fittipaldi, Ronnie Peterson cars, 72, 73, that was fantastic, iconic livery.
Did you have a Scalextric when you were growing up? Yeah. Because I remember when we got one for Christmas and the two cars in the pack, there was a red March Ford. And there was the John Player Special Lotus. And literally, there was an argument and a fight every day to see who got it.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm a bit older than you, but mine had sort of generic one red one, one green one kind of 1960s cigar-shaped thing, So I think you had a better Scalextric set than I did.
I want to talk about some of the drivers and beginning, not with the modern era, but I want to go back to Ascari, whose yeah. father died at the French Grand Prix back in July of 1918 when Alberto was just seven. And he was desperate, wasn't he, to follow his father into racing cars.
Yeah, he was. And, he ended up having an accident at Monaco just 4 days before he died, where he actually went into the harbour and sort of quite spookily, he was wearing a borrowed crash helmet and his father was as well. And it was the same day of the month and all that kind of thing. So I think he believed in things like fates and that kind of thing.
He got a break, didn't he, in the Mille Miglia, which, of course, was the thing. I think anybody that's listening to this that has seen the film Ferrari will know all about this. This was in 1940, and still he was only 22 years of age when he was in there, and he linked up, hadn't he, with Enzo Ferrari.
Yeah, I know that as you talk about, it was a fantastic and highly dangerous race, the Mille Miglia, which obviously went on to, I think that was one of Moss's great victories, the one that he had in 55 there with Dennis Jenkinson, where, Jenks had his pace notes on Boswell kind of thing, and that was I think one of Stirling's greatest drives.
There was a real battle, wasn't there, between the manufacturers then? It was Maserati was king and Ferrari was the sort of, the brat child, the up and coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as Merck came in with, great massive effort and I think after Stirling had won that for Burke, he actually drove back to Stuttgart overnight, having won it, because they wanted to see him the next day in Stuttgart or something. So I think it took 10 hours for the race almost. And then, he drove overnight.
It's fabulous, isn't it? And people tend to forget or maybe didn't really know that in the early 50s, 52, when Ascari won six of the Grand Prix in Europe, had nine consecutive wins between June 52 in Spa and then June 53 when he returned to Spa. And that record stood until Vettel equaled it in 2013. What an achievement that was at that time.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And I think back then, though, if you had a superior car, it was well superior. Whereas still a fantastic achievement, but, I think to do it nowadays is even more admirable in a way because the competition is so much closer than it was back then.
Those duels of the era, of course, with Fangio and Stirling Moss, and the famous Monza Grand Prix where Ascari, Fangio, and Farina the front three neck and neck, literally all the way.
Yeah. That was fantastic. I think, and there was a back marker involved, wasn't there? In the drama,
Yeah,
the
yeah.
last lap, I think, and the parabolica, they all tripped over each other at the parabolica on the last lap or something. So, it was a typical Monza slipstream, I
His
think.
mother was really against him getting involved with
Yeah.
racing due to the fact that she'd been widowed, and the ultimate tragedy would strike for him as well. And the irony is, it wasn't even in a Grand Prix race, was it?
No, absolutely not. I think he drove up to he I think he drove it was 4 days after he'd been in the harbour at Monaco, and he drove up to Monza because they were testing a sports car up there, and he was sitting having some lunch, and he decided he was gonna go out and do a few laps in the car. And he went out in basically, I think, his suit, trousers, and a borrowed helmet. And they don't actually know what happened.
Yeah, you see that this is the other thing about the book is you're reading the stories and then you're seeing the pictures, because I think you do see
Yeah.
the picture of the car that he crashed
The
in.
wreckage, yeah.
He'd gone up to meet a guy called Eugenio Castellotti,
That's the lot.
who
That's right.
was one of the up and coming drivers that he'd
He's
been
a bit of a
at.
young protege, I think,
But
and yeah.
you're right, because the father, Antonio and Alberto, both killed on the same day of the month, weren't they? The
That's correct,
26th,
yeah. And both wearing
both wearing
borrowed
borrowed
crash helmets.
helmets. I mean,
Yeah.
it really is
It's spooky.
as if there was something written, or
Yeah.
there was, I don't know, there was dark arts at work. I mean, it just makes you shiver a bit, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it was something I think that you believed in as well, Ascari. You know, he was aware of all that kind of thing. So that makes it all the more, you know. I don't think I'd have borrowed a crash helmet and gone out if I'd
Especially
been
after
in.
lunch, because you listen, how
Absolutely.
many times you've been to Italy and sat and had an Italian lunch?
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's kind of like that. I think they used to sit and have their glass of red wine
Yeah,
and then go out and
a
turn up
couple
and
of
drive.
courses, a couple of cigarettes, and a
Yeah.
bit of Sambuca. Now, as time goes by, these great achievements which are recorded and new legends come along and other names maybe grow a little dimmer each day. I wonder how many of today's young F1 fans will have heard the name and know anything about Mike Hawthorn, the Farnham Flyer.
Probably. Well, the scary thing is, I come across people who haven't heard of
Oh my
Ayrton
God.
Senna, never mind Mike Hawthorn. It is, but then you think back and you think, well, blimey, it's 30 years ago. So yeah, but Hawthorn, yeah, you know, I think Moss was the kind of one that everyone remembers from that era. But Hawthorn, of course, was the first British world champion,
And the
1958.
first, wasn't he the first British driver to win a Grand Prix at Ram in the early
Yeah,
50s? And
yeah, he was.
if you go along and you're looking through the rest of these stories, and you'll see, yeah, we know the cars that they have now and the cars have gone in the past, but his debut was in a Riley.
Different days, but when you look back at some of those, you know, the pictures from that era, and you sort of see them sort of hanging out of cockpits and wearing sort of a linen crash helmet and goggles, and you think, and you know, you think forward to today, and the safety standards they've got, and hands devices and carbon and this, and they don't catch fire anymore, and it is a completely different era, isn't it? I mean, you know, I think it what was it? It was Hemingway who said only bullfighting and motor racing, you know, are real sports, the rest of his games.
His talent was spotted early as well, wasn't he? He was recommended to Enzo Ferrari, who got him over to Italy.
Yeah, indeed. So, and as he did with Moss as well, and then, you know, Moss got there, and they decided to give the car to somebody else and hadn't bothered telling him after he went all the way to Bari, I think. So he vowed that he would never drive for, I mean, Hawthorn won his championship with Ferrari, and Moss vowed he would never drive for Ferrari.
Things turned a bit sour, though, because there were regulation changes coming in as well as form dropped off. And there was that deferral of national service to join Ferrari, which didn't really go down very well, did it? And there were thoughts about him retiring to run the family business.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, indeed. I think, you know, back, I'm trying to remember the year when national service was phased out, but it was well after that. And yeah, I think you're right. You know, anything that caused you to escape it, if you like, wasn't regarded well.
He did go back to Ferrari and won the Spanish Grand Prix, and then came those incredibly tragic events in Le Mans, where, what was it, 84 people lost their lives. Mercedes withdrew, Jaguar didn't. I mean, it seems quite incredible now that that actually went ahead after what happened.
Yeah, it does now, but you know, that kind of was the way it was back then. You know, I remember, there was awful instances in Grand Prix, even, you know, much later than that. You go on almost 20 years and you had people like, you know, Roger Williamson in an upturned car, you know, burning at Zandvoort, and you know, they didn't even stop the race, you know. Cars are just flying past, and of course, you know, his friend David Purley stopped and got out and tried to right the car and everything, but, you know, there's nothing he could do, and you know, that was as late as sort of 73, you know, when nothing caused the race to be stopped.
the title winning race, and again, I mean, I sort of lost touch of it with F1 over the years. There was anything but a predictable finale back in these days, and that final race with the Farnham Flyer was in Casablanca, and you had Stirling Moss needing to finish first. But not only that, he needed to have a record fastest lap, and Hawthorne needed to finish no lower than second. I mean, what drama.
Yeah, absolutely. And that year, to be honest, Moss had already, I think it was the previous race in Portugal, basically, Moss had won, and I think Hawthorne was way behind in second, and he spun, and he tried to restart the car, and he was disqualified for driving in the wrong direction. But Moss, who'd driven past him when it happened, saw that he actually wasn't on the circuit, and he went to the stewards and said, "No, you can't disqualify him because he wasn't actually on the circuit. He was fine doing what he was doing. It wasn't against the rules." And so they reinstated Hawthorne. And had they not done that, Moss would have been champion that year.
Oh, that is pretty incredible, actually.
Yeah.
And then, a bit like Ascari, we end up with a life ending in ultimately tragic circumstances, and again, nowhere near a racetrack. You know, he's gone through everything that he did on a racetrack, and then dies in January of 1959, 22nd of January 1959, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about what actually happened in this. The down on the A3 at Hog's Back, he crashed and he died. He was only 29 years of age. And it was rumoured that he was involved in basically a chase, you know, a race. Yeah. Rob Walker, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Who had sort of stopped by on the forecourt, I think, and beeped and that kind of thing. And supposedly Mike jumped into his, his jug and took off after him.
And Walker has been at pains to deny that they were ever racing, and it was just simply an accident.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, and you know, it was whatever. You know, the circumstances, it was an awful accident, and I think, you know, it was a wet road and windy, and you know, he was clearly going too quick and hitting the sort of the only tree around for, you know, for miles.
Yeah, can you imagine if that had been 30 years on, he'd have been driving a Quattro something or other and he would have gone around like he was on rails, wouldn't he?
On rails, absolutely, yeah.
Now, I've got to move into the 70s, which you just was one more, because I think this was the real glamour decade, the evolution of cars as a brand, the colours, the advertising, and everything that went with it. And we had the likes of Jackie Stewart, Mario Andretti, Jochen Rindt, of course, Fittipaldi, and one James Hunt.
That was a fantastic era. I think it was, well, I mean, the thing that pulled me into it, I was only eight, and I saw, back in those days, you got sort of, I think 10 minutes of three races a year. You used to get a bit of Monaco, a bit of the British Grand Prix, and a bit of the Italian Grand Prix from Monza. And I remember watching Silverstone 69, and it was Stewart versus Rindt. And I was kind of I'd become a bit of a Stewart fan. And it was just a fantastic race. You know, they must have, you know, changed lead about 15 times or something, you know, you didn't know who was going to win it, and then in the end, I think Rindt had a car problem, and I think the wing bent and fouled the tyre and gave him a puncture, and it was actually Stewart who drew alongside and pointed at his rear tyre and had to warn him he had a puncture because Rindt didn't realise, I don't think. So I just thought that, you know, I love competition and I love cars, and this was just both, and I was just hooked from that moment on as an 8-year-old, you know.
James and, had that sort of caddish playboy veneer, didn't he? I mean, it was a little bit like Simon Templar at the time. Yeah. And let's not forget as well, we also had Barry Sheen came through at the time. So literally, I mean, we were the centre of the motor racing world on two and four wheels for a period.
No, you're right, actually. It's a good analogy, the Simon Templar one, because I was a great fan of the Saint and his Volvo P1800 and all that. And you know, I watched that as a child as well. And then the battle between Hunt and Niki Lauda for the 76 World Championship, that's the thing that took motor racing from the back pages to the front, and increased the awareness to the point where, you know, Eccleston saw the commercial promise and it took it on so much. But I mean, that was a fantastic battle. You know, obviously they made a film about it called Rush, which came out in 2013, and that was it was pretty true to it. But you couldn't have made that up, you know.
Nothing.
Everything would happen that year.
I mean, he had a very sort of middle class upbringing, didn't he? He was privately educated, played at Junior Wimbledon, which maybe not many people did. And wouldn't you have loved to have been around the dinner table when he said to his parents, I mean, you can imagine evening dinner, you know, was in progress, and he'd told them that he wasn't going to med school, he was going to be a racing driver.
I'm going to be a racing driver. I'm going to be world champion. You'd have gone, yeah, wouldn't you?
he endeared himself as well to the public because he wasn't perfect. He's prone to losing his cool. There's the incident with the F3 race, which was on television Saturday afternoon grandstand when his rival Dave Morgan. There was a collision, wasn't it? And he got out and landed and lamped him one.
He did, yeah. He did it to more than he lamped a marshal as well. When I think he got taken off by his own teammate in Canada in 76, and then, you know, the guy came across to help and make sure he was all right. And he got lamped as well.
he was a bit of a loose cannon. I mean, they weren't queuing up to sign him. And so he, what did he call him? Is that I ended up with the good Lord Hesketh.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, and that was, you know, you couldn't make that up either, could you? A bunch of sort of hooray Henrys come along and decide that, you know, they're going to go Formula One. They end up with him, you know, a bit of a glamour boy and you know, finishing in places he shouldn't have done. But of course, in those days, you could have someone design a car, buy a Cosworth V8 engine from off the shelf and stick it in the back, and you'd be somewhere near competitive if the driver was good.
And let's not forget that the Red Tops were doing brisk business, and they were, there was the glamour cover, wasn't it? Susie Miller.
Yeah.
I mean, met her in Spain, married her the same year they met, ends up in divorce after she meets up with Richard Burton in a ski resort.
Absolutely.
And he allegedly paid James Hunt $1 million as part of the divorce settlement.
Fantastic days, and you know, he used to write a column. I used to read Autosport back in the day, and before I ended up working for it, and he used to write a column in there, and you know, some of his escapades, and relate, you know, the fun they had, and it was, you know, I think it'd be wrong to say it wasn't professional, but you know, these days, you know, just about every, you know, minute that the guys have is taken up with, you know, this appearance or that appearance or this sponsor or that sponsor. But, you know, back then it seemed to be a bit more footloose and fancy free, didn't it?
Yeah. Can you imagine Lewis Hamilton having a chat with his, with whoever he's going to be racing with, and sitting there and saying, yeah, well, this stipulation is in this contract, I've got to wear a blazer and slacks. Well, that isn't happening. And that was the deal with Hunt, wasn't it? McLaren nearly failed due to the fact that they wanted him to look smart.
That's right. He nearly nearly scuppered the deal. The big sponsor guru at the time was a chap called John Hogan, and you know, he was sort of Marlborough's man. And I think John sorted out in the end. He said, listen, James, I'll make sure you never have to wear a blazer, but, you know, I'll make sure you don't, you know, you might occasionally have to wear a blazer, but you can forget the flip-flops. You can't wear flip-flops, you'll have to wear shoes.
Brilliant. But that season, we've touched on it, Hunt and Lauda, the most compelling in history. And people forget, when you look at the halfway point of that season, Lauda was sat on 55 points. James Hunt is on 8. And then there was 3 retirements. They got the appeal for the DQ in Spain, due to the width of the car then.
It was a couple of millimetres too wide.
Yeah.
It was mainly tyre squash, I think, mainly. But it was bizarre because, funnily enough, they didn't go there in the film, but Nicky had turned a tractor over on himself before that race. He was building a house in Hof in Austria, and his tractor, you know, fell over on him, almost killed him. He was fortunate, broke a couple of ribs, and he was driving in Spain with, you know, pain killing injections, and I think then James forced down the inside of him, put him over a curb, knocked all the wind out of him, and went on to win, and then, you know, then James was disqualified. So, you know. Nicky got his points, you know, nursing his, he drove at a Corsa, it was nursing his ribs, but, you know, they didn't even bother with that in the film because they had so much other things to go on, you know.
And then, by the time they got to the British Grand Prix, he got up to 35 points, but he was still 23 behind. And then we get more controversy over this use of a spare car after the accident. And he was taking avoidance measures, quote, when Lauda and Regazzoni clashed. And then that all ended up in a controversy.
Yeah, again, you know, you had to feel a bit sorry for James because he was, you know, it was Nicky and Clay who caused the accident at the head of the field. And you know, he ended up with a damaged car. And, you know, it technically by the letter of the law, he shouldn't have been able to restart. And then obviously he lost those points later, which gave, you know, Nicky what looked like an insurmountable lead with 3 to go, which was when James went a bit potty in, you know, in Canada and just, you know, sort of the booze and the boots and the birds and all the rest of it. Yeah.
you forget, before it even got there, you had the Nürburgring, where it was feared that Lauda literally would be lucky to get up and walk again. Many people feared that he was about to lose his life. And then, from the position he was in after that accident, 39 days later. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? 39 days, under a month, he's back for Monza. Now, you imagine if that had happened now, the medics or the FI simply wouldn't allow it.
No, I think you probably got a point there. I think the, although, you know, the things that nearly killed him were the toxic fumes from the burning Ferrari. And, you know, his his blood oxygen count. And I think once he'd, I mean, obviously he had some awful burns and everything, but I think once he'd recovered from the lung problem, there was actually no physical reason why, you know, he couldn't do it. But I mean, you know, it looked horrendous because, you know, he was wearing, you know, his balaclava was blood soaked when he took it off because the, you know, the wounds hadn't healed and all that kind of thing. And you know, Enzo Ferrari hadn't figured on him coming back because he, you know, he'd hired Carlos Reutemann. Yet Nicky turns up at Monza and he's a, you know, he's the best finishing Ferrari, or he's the fastest Ferrari that weekend. You think, you know, what a fantastic effort.
But Hunt had got to within 2 points.
Yeah.
But then it's still not a clear run-in, is it? Because then there's the fuel mix-up.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
ended up with him literally being stood down. The car didn't actually qualify.
That's right. I mean, it was all to do with the octane level, and it was Ferrari territory, and it was Italy, and it was all a bit, you know, it was all a bit of a controversy. But when Nicky got the... James lost his points again from the British Grand Prix. You know, it was, as far as everybody was concerned, it was more or less all done and dusted.
The Canadian Grand Prix, then Hunt wins in the US, and yeah, the finale in Japan. And it was the very first Grand Prix in Japan.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, probably shouldn't have started.
And Lauda was out as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he stopped because one of the problems was from the Nürburgring accident and the burns he had. He the eyelids were burnt, and he couldn't blink away tears properly. So when you had the combination of, you know, the poor visibility, the rain, the mist, and he also couldn't, you know, misting visors and that kind of thing, and he also couldn't blink away tears, you know, he realized that, you know, it was, he couldn't do it, and he just drove a slow lap and then parked.
And then even that isn't the end of the drama, is it? Because Hunt ends up with a 27-second pit stop, which meant that he thought that he lost it, which is why he was going berserk the crew at the end of the race, because he didn't realise.
He went back into the race fifth. And passed a couple of cars, but he didn't know he was fifth. Passed a couple of cars, he had no idea where he'd finished, I don't think, and thought they'd blown it, you know, with the pit stop, and was obviously remonstrating with Teddy Mayer, the team boss, and then somebody sort of tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Calm down, you world champion."
And then, I mean, so sad to see that he too passed very early back in June 93, aged just 45. And we got used to hearing him with Murray Walker. They had a great partnership on the BBC. But the quote from Lauda, which I loved, on Hunt's death, he said he was one of the few people that he liked, Lauda liked, a smaller number of people that he respected, and the only one that he ever envied. there's a thing, because there's a book about Max Verstappen that is coming out next week, or the next couple of weeks, and we're going to be talking about that one as well.
Oh, right, okay.
Brilliant. There you go. I'm going to stop that now.
Okay.
What a great quote.
It is a great quote, and I think that, you know, they did have a genuine respect and friendship for each other, and you know, right through from the Formula 3 days, when, you know, it was absolutely manic, and I think they'd actually they'd gone out and had a discussion about, you know, the way this is going, we're unlikely to survive, so let's have a good time, you know.
And one of the reasons we all used to like him, you know. And you either, when you were growing up, wanted to be Barry Sheen or James Hunt. The great story about his wedding day, when he married Sarah Lomax, I think. He arrives late to the service. The service is delayed because he didn't have a tie, and his brother had to whip up the high street to find one.
Yeah. No, he was a one-off, a great character, and did so much, I think, for, you know, to popularise the sport.
So when you look back at the history, which is beautifully summed up pictorially and editorially in this book, when you discuss who is the greatest of all time, it simply isn't a case, is it, of, well, it's going to be driver X because he won the most. It isn't just about that.
No, it's not. It's about a whole mix of things.
So who was the greatest then? You've spent your entire life following the sport, so you should be as qualified as any.
The greatest I've seen, and I haven't seen Fangio and Moss was before my time, but the greatest I've seen is Senna.
Mm. And lastly then, who's going to win the championship in 2024?
I think there's a good chance it'll be Max Verstappen.
Well, that was author and motor racing journalist Tony Dodgins talking about his new book. It's called Formula One, The Legends, Cult Drivers and Their Legacies. It is out now. And if you enjoyed that, then you will also enjoy the program we did with Maurice Hamilton, a journalist and author who put together the Formula One official history book last year. You can find that on the website or stream it from any platform. Moving on then, Pete Carville has spent 20 plus years inside boxing and he's just released his new book. It is called Death of a Boxer, and this is quite different to most of the books that we've featured, certainly on this program, because it isn't a book really that praises the sport. Rather, it highlights some of the tragedies and the brutality and what it is really like for those who operate away from the glitzy, bright lights of the TV super shows. This isn't a love letter, is it, to the sport of boxing? I mean, we have tragedy here. There's a degree of respect for those who go under the radar, who commit and basically give everything they have to a sport for scant reward. And the one quote that stood out for me in the book was toward the end of the book. It says, and I think it could have been in there to start, and you actually said, and this is the quote from obviously of the book, here's the thing about boxing. Most people, obviously, before they know much, will hate it. They hate it with a passion because they see only brutality and damage. Then they learn. Then they begin to love it by degrees. Then you love it. Then you see the damage it inflicts at the end and you hate it all over again. Now, is this you that is saying this? Your view and your opinion.
I would say that it's about me, but it's also what I've observed over 20 years of being in this business, being around boxing and being around fight gyms and fighters, is that, yes, you start off when you're 15, 16, 17, in my case, a little bit older when I was 19, and you get into it and you love it because these are superheroes and it's fun and it's exciting. And you think as well as a young man that that's how men are supposed to be, and then you learn it, and then so you have that thing where you have hated it as a child, and then you get into it and you're like, oh wow, this is great, this is so good. And then when you hit a certain age, or when you can watch it for a certain amount of time, and you see the damage that it does to people, and you see the people that you watch when you were young, and you see how they become damaged and broken, and you always thought that when they were younger, when you were young, that they weren't going to get damaged or broken, that somehow you would be the exception to the rule. And then, as we always find out in life, is that the rules are the rules for a reason. And so, yeah, you begin to hate it again.
But is that just a bit of a generalization? Because not everybody that concludes a career is damaged beyond repair.
Well, it's a fairly strong generalization. I mean, I think studies and statistics show that about 80% of fighters will have long-term cognitive damage at the end of their careers. I mean, if you grow up loving people and if you grow up loving the fighters and then you see them at the end when they are damaged, even the guys that seem to be you know, you may have a lot of guys that seem to be doing okay, but then there are a lot of guys that don't do okay at the end of it. And that's why you hate it, because you say, oh my God, it's done this to somebody.
Because you mentioned you getting involved in it, and it's just about 20 years ago, you're heading into All Saints Boxing Gym in York. I was easily intimidated. I was a tall, skinny teen. I wanted to be a man, and the road involved pain, and you wanted the ability to inflict it.
Yeah, because when I was 19, I left home, and I was a fairly sheltered 19-year-old, and I went out into North Yorkshire, where I was living in York, and I went into a sport of bars and nightclubs and bouncers and quite scary guys. And there were people that you look back now and you think, God, that person was obviously mentally unstable. But that was the world I was thrust into. And these were in some ways, the men that were admired. And yeah, I got into boxing. And as a 19-year-old as well, your body's still developing. So I was gaining what we call man strength at the time.
And you experience things that a lot of others do, and a lot of other fighters as well, when they first turn up into the gym. Basically, the coaches look at you and laugh at you.
they did, because I had no coordination and I'm short-sighted, and I couldn't get anything right. And I fairly much dedicated myself to doing it for, I'd say, a couple of years, but really about 6-7 months in, I had done all the basics. I knew how to move my feet, I knew how to stand, I knew how to hold my balance, I knew how to throw punches. And that was also a lesson in itself. I learned that if you turn up every day and you work hard at something, then you eventually will achieve something at the end. And that's lesson that I've learned. That's probably one of the most important lessons I've learned in my life. And I got that through boxing.
Yeah, and after a year, you've said in here that you ended up demonstrating the basics to newcomers. So you appeared to take everything on board fairly quickly, and the results were easy to see after a year.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at pictures of me from the start of that first year to the end of the second year, there's a marked difference. I lost about 2 stone. You can see that my arms were not huge, but you can see the muscle tone in my arms. And I was carrying myself a lot different as well. Like, I'd shed the baby fat that I'd had at 19 and 20. And I was walking around the base as a man. I'd gone from a boy to a man in those 2 years.
Did you actually want to be a boxer, a fighter?
Yeah, I still do.
Okay.
I still do. Don't we all? Right. No. I when I was around about that time, 19, 20, I said to my coaches in the gym, said, well, can I get a couple of fights just at the amateur level? And they said, well, you can't see that far. And my attitude at the time was, they're not going to be standing that far away from me. And they said, look, you're not going to pass the medical. And I went, oh, okay. So I ended up just essentially being the sparring partner for everybody, because I'm left-handed, I'm a southpaw. Yeah, so I was the one southpaw in the gym. So because I mean, I'm not saying I was that much good, but because I was the one southpaw, I was the one guy they could always practice against when they were getting ready for a southpaw. So I just became a sparring. I did hundreds of rounds of sparring. But yeah, I mean, if you'd asked me back then, I would have done it. If you'd asked me in my mid-20s, I would have done it. And now I'm 42. And I look back and I think, well, maybe if I give it 6 months and, you know, I started running again and get some hill sprints in, and then, you know, maybe I'll run for a day or two. And I remember, no, my knees hurt for a reason. My ankles hurt for a reason. I can't do this anymore.
What took you to Germany?
So I was working in London, which is actually where I am right now. And I was working for a magazine, and I was made redundant, and I was kind of kicking around London. I'd been there for a few years, and I didn't really have anything going on in my life. I had nothing tying me down, you know. And I thought, well, where can I go that's fairly cheap to live and looks kind of cool? So originally I looked at moving to Paris, and then Paris was too expensive. And then someone said to me, why don't you look at Berlin? And I said, well, I haven't thought about Berlin. So I started looking at Berlin, and Berlin was, at the time, very cheap to live. There was a thriving art scene there, and
absolutely,
I thought, yeah, I'll do this, you know. And that's how I moved out, and I ended up staying.
There was a big boxing scene over there, the reason I know a lot about it is because basically we used to cover it on Eurosport literally weekly. We had live fights, and the names that you mentioned in the book, Marco Huck, obviously, King Arthur, the Klitschko's, we covered many, many, many times. Over the years, King Arthur. We wondered why there was always the great boxing cliche about fighting King Arthur or Huck. You'd have to knock him down half a dozen times to draw.
Yeah, seriously, one of the reasons I ended up in Germany as well, they had good boxing at the time, which shows you where my mindset was. I've written about Marco Huck in the past, and Marco Huck is one of those guys. I think he defended his title something like 18 times as a cruiserweight. And the miracle is not that he defended 18 times, but there was 18 people on the planet that couldn't beat him. But that said about Huck, with Huck and Abraham, the rumor always going around, and the rumor in the German press, is that what happened with these two guys was they turned up to this the Sauerland gym in Berlin. The Sauerland were the big promoters. And they turned up at the gym and they were looking for work as sparring partners. And there was nobody in Germany who was actually a star at the time. And so the Sauerlands looked at these two guys who obviously knew a little bit and went, you know what, why don't you just put them in with people that we know they can beat and make them into stars? And that's how those guys ended up being so protected and so popular in Germany. They were built up into
huge crowds every time we did a live event. The place was absolutely full to the brim. The atmosphere was great. They were hugely popular. But moving on from that, you then saw the story of Mike Towell, who, as we know, lost his life to boxing. So was this the point where your views on the sport began to alter here? Because again, you know, when you look at the details of this tragedy, which is exactly what it was, you do still feel that this could have been avoided. There was no need for this to happen.
Yeah. I mean, that was fairly obvious from the fatal accident inquiry that came out later that it should not have happened. Now there are many reasons why it did happen, like many ways that he slipped through the net, as it were. But my thoughts on boxing didn't really start changing my thoughts on boxing. Those thoughts were already there. What happened was I read a report about what's in my book, and I found that the paperwork was quite freely available. It's a 180 something page report. It makes a little bit longer. I read the entire report, and I read it and I thought, wow, this is an interesting story, because the original pitch for the book was I wanted to write essentially, do you know the book Into the Wild by John Krakauer?
Yes.
So I wanted to write essentially like a martial arts stroke boxing version of Into the Wild, and the book really would have solely focused on Mike Towell. There wouldn't have been any of the other people that I spoke to would have gone the book. It was solely would have been a book about Mike Towell. But that, for me, was the interesting part of the story, is that Mike Towell's identity was entirely wrapped up with being a boxer. You know, and I think I write in the book, you take away what a man does and you take away a piece of him, right? Or you take away his entirety.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
when you think about, we talk about missed opportunities, he was doing this for the potential to, on this particular occasion, obviously we don't know what would have happened afterwards, but this was for the potential to take him £4,935 maximum in this final eliminator for the British welterweight championship. So he was given 12 weeks unpaid leave to train. So again, basically, the actual cost was probably more than he was going to win.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the sad thing. But he would see things that Mike Towell. I mean, I can't speak for Mike Towell because I've never spoke to him in life. But I would say, judging from, like, I know fighters, right? I know the mentality behind that. And I think Mike Towell losing that 12 weeks worth of money, he would have been able to say, okay, that's just 12 weeks. There's lots of 12 weeks periods in your life. But he might have been the British champion. And that's something that's something that no one can take away from you.
For the people that don't know the story here is the reason why I'm just going to talk a bit about this, because with the passing of time, maybe people forget, maybe they didn't know in the first place. But you can pick up warning signals when you look at this almost from day one. When he went to that first training session in Edinburgh, he got in the ring and it didn't go well, and he gets out and he says, I've taken a real hiding.
Yeah.
I'm not going back there. And the coach or the trainer at the time just says, yeah, you'll get better. Don't worry.
The warnings about his medical condition started, I think, years before that. He was having seizures, and then he was telling one story was getting told to one doctor, one story was getting told to another. There were multiple occasions on which he had medical evaluations as part of his boxing career, getting ready for fights or getting his annual license, where they would say to him, any seizures or issues, such as this, no. And it was obvious that it was well documented that he was having.
Very, very short period of time after that, he's on the phone to a secretary of the boxing club with the, I've got pain in my side, I went down whilst running, I've been sick, I've got neck pain, I need a massage. That was obviously what he was thinking at the time. But again, another red flag, before his doctor was concerned about him because they talked about abdominal pain and then suggested a GP appointment. He comes back and says, yeah, all good, no symptoms. And on the 9th of September, again, severe abdominal pain actually stopped me running before he ends up in hospital after the sparring session, when he actually asked for a scan, and the nurse at the time said, I don't think you need it. I think it's stress.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much of what happened later was related to the pain in his side. And I did reach out to the NHS in Scotland, and they obviously would not talk about what had gone on. For me, and this is obviously is my opinion, I'm not a doctor, is I don't understand how a man who's been punched in the head repeatedly by people trained in the art of punching people in the head doesn't get a brain scan if he's in that much pain.
He came in as well, didn't he? Overweight for that fight, which meant more exertion. To get down from 149 to 147.
Yeah, we don't know. Come up, to be over by 2 pounds is not unheard of. It depends. It depends on how tight he was to get down to 149 in the first place. If he was a little bit complacent in getting down to 149, he could have taken 2 pounds off quite easily. But it depends if he's starved at the weight, if he's really dry at the weight to get down to 149 in the first place, those last 2 pounds would have been agonizing.
And the fight itself, obviously, it didn't go well. He was down twice, and then the conclusion where he takes 4 or 5 punches before they stop, and the call for oxygen, and it was revealed that there was a brain bleed which was inoperable.
Yeah, it's a tragic story. And again, there's so much of it that we can't know for sure. We don't know how much the seizures were related to what came after. But overall, I think it's fairly obvious that things were not right, and it's fairly obvious that he should not have been in the ring that night.
Now, we do look at other aspects of the fight game and the opening act. So these are the fighters who open events, usually in front of huge empty auditoriums or small hall empty auditoriums. And again, we see here how little glamour and money there is. Zoe Hunt-Smith is the fighter who is talked about in this book, arriving at Bethnal Green to the York Hall. And again, these things that people maybe don't know. So they go straight in and up to the organisers to, quote, pay in.
Yes. So what happens, I don't know if you'd like me to sort of go over how this works, is that...
Yeah, I think, as you're writing about it, I think it's good to explain these things, because people just think that, you rock up, you've got your entourage, you get in the ring and you take a big bag of money home at the end of the night. And it is so far removed from that.
It is. So Zoe, who I might be seeing Zoe tonight, actually. I hope, and she's read the book, so I'm hoping she liked it. So what happened with Zoe that day is what happens with boxers always on the undercard is they get given a certain amount of tickets to sell. And then once they've sold those tickets, they put in a certain – they have to pay the promoters, the organizers, sorry, a certain amount of money to be on the card. So in Zoe's case, she paid the organizers, I think, $3,500. Now, of that $3,500 that she paid, $2,000 was going to Zoe's opponent. And the opponent was a journeywoman. His name escapes me right now. So the opponent was getting $2,000. The organizers had their cut of the money as well. From what Orton. Was left o- sorry?
Orton. Orton, was it?
Kerry Orton, yeah. So what was left over, Zoe then paid... she had to pay for her own cutman. She had to pay for her own trainer. So she's paid her cutman. She's paid her trainer. She's paid her opponent. She's paid her promoters. And she's trained herself. And she fought, I think, 4 rounds that night. And she made £200 for the whole thing.
And people simply wouldn't believe you if you didn't actually break it down. And the economics of small hall shows, you know, where the fighter sells the tickets to make the money and keep what's left after the promoters. See, Gary Lockett's quoted in the book, and he was quite forthright. Listen, all people know is the television shows, and he explained a situation he had. It was a Russian, I think, who was making his debut, and he said, the guy cost $1,650. My guy's got to sell the tickets to pay. So let's say he sells $3,000. We've got $1,350 left. The promoter gets $675. But what actually happened was his guy sold 1,300 quid's worth. So Gary then pays the $350 to make up the $1,650. So the fighter gets nothing, and neither did Gary Lockett.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And what's, just as an aside here, Gary's a really good person to speak to about that because he's an accountant.
Yeah, yeah.
When he's not training fighters. And Gary's a former British champion himself, so he knows the game inside and out. But yeah, like the economics of it are brutal. And you really only make money in this trade if you are in that top, 5%, as it were. The best way to actually make money from the start is to have an Olympic gold medal. And that's when you get all the backing, and that's when you get the opponents that are chosen to match your strengths, as it were.
Like, so and let's not forget as well, by the way, that promoters, and again, I think we mentioned this in the book, pull shows if tickets aren't selling. 2-3 days notice, there's an 8-fight bill. They need to be making $1,000 from each one. If it doesn't get to that target, then that's it. Gone.
Yeah.
Joe's gone. You've trained all that period for nothing.
Yes. And then the fighter has to pay everybody back as well, which in a way, and it doesn't bode well for the next time. Because if you've bought a ticket off someone for $50, and that fight gets cancelled 2 days before and you get your $50 back. Well, you're not going to do that a second time round. You're not going to go, why should I give you another $50 if you're just going to cancel on me again? So, it's brutal. At the lower end of it, it's absolutely brutal. But I'd like to say as well that I spent a good few hours with Zoe on the night she had her fight. And Zoe, I have so much gratitude for, because I was supposed to interview somebody else that weekend, and that person pulled out at the last minute, and I had to find someone to fill that slot of, the undercard fighter. And I messaged Zoe. I didn't know. I messaged her on Facebook, I think it was, and she just came back within 20 minutes and said, sure, meet me around the back of the York Hall. So I'm eternally grateful to Zoe for doing that.
Yeah, and again, just highlighting the glamour or the lack of it, 6 o'clock ring time, dressing room, you've got a guy who's your cut man for the night, you probably don't even know, who's hired, no manager. So she's got a stand-in who's doing a favour to the other guy who's actually in Telford at a show. They've got 30 people in the audience who watched. Mm-hmm. She wins and then goes in. There's no showers there. Showers, just change, pay the cut man, leave, go back in and watch your mate on the next thing, and you've done it all. As we said, for 200 quid.
Mm-hmm. And then she's back in the gym on Monday. getting ready for the next fight. That's dedication.
But let's move on anyway, sure, and talk a bit about the decline, you know, measuring decline in boxers as to decline in normal, you know, human beings. Boxers, you know, you talk about it being dramatic and is seen over a few fights, and then how people go about managing it. Yeah, putting you in with smaller, faster opponents to stem the loss of speed, secret sparring behind closed doors, easier matchups to get those last few paydays, you know, legs going first, so concentrating on technique, reflexes going, and punches that once missed now connecting. It's a very familiar tale. All of those things, people who love the sport have seen and watched and commented on many, many times.
This is It's one of those. I always say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So you see the same stories time and time again. Actually, it happened to me. I was still sparring into my 30s, and then I noticed that I was sparring at nearly 35, and I couldn't do at that age what I'd been able to do 10 years before. And that was when I realized it's now time to stop, because I'd lost that gear, that fifth gear. I could get into like gear 3 and gear 4. But I'd lost that fifth gear. I was getting hit with things that I didn't see coming in. I was getting hit by, I was being made to look like a fool a lot of the time by young kids in the ring who were just faster than me. And I had the awareness to say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And also I'd reached a point in life where I didn't want to get hit anymore as well. A lot of fighters, that happens with a lot of fighters. You see a guy quits on a stool on the eighth round, and he's 36, 37 years old. Everyone's like, oh, no, we quit. And he's like, and at some point, I think you just, your body tells you, and then I think the body tells you first, then the mind catches up, and the body just says, I don't want to be hit anymore.
In the same chapter, you start to talk about Jermaine Taylor coming into those fights with Bernard Hopkins, who... Yeah. Been beaten twice, Clint Mitchell and Roy Jones Jr. at his absolute peak. Now, Taylor was unbeaten at this time.
Yeah.
So why did you pick this particular moment in his career? Because, I mean, obviously I can't go back and watch every fight beforehand, but had you seen something in the lead up to this? Because, I mean, he was the undisputed champion. At that time, he was unbeaten. He was being talked about as being, you know, literally the next Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, he had everything going for him. So why did you pick this moment in time?
For Jermaine Taylor.
Taylor against Bernard Hopkins to start this particular thread of the story.
Well, if you look at what happened with Jermaine Taylor after the Bernard Hopkins fight. So the Bernard Hopkins fights were both of them controversial, where many people thought that Hopkins had taken the result. And then you saw afterwards, and it may not have been entirely inside the ring. I think Taylor had some lifestyle issues outside of it. But you saw immediately after those fights that he started to go on the decline. And I think the reason that I picked Taylor for the book was that Taylor was, when I was, you know, this is going back 20 years now, when I was in the first flush of love, shall we say, with boxing, Taylor was the guy. He was, as you know, for an older generation, for my father's generation, my father remembers watching Ray Leonard, and Ray Leonard was the big star. And for me, that time in life, Jermaine Taylor was the big star, and his career promised so much, and then it just declined so quickly. If you look, he had the draw against Winky Wright, he struggled against Kathy Boomer. He struggled against, pardon me, he struggled against a bunch of people, and then you see him fighting guys like Jeff Lacy, I think. Yeah, and then you start seeing the fact that he goes from being on the A side of the card to the B side. So you see him get starched by Carl Froch in the 12th round. He then goes into the Super Six against Arthur Abraham. Abraham starches him in the 12th round as well.
But it's not. Is it a case when you look back at that? He was beaten by Kelly Pavlik twice.
Yeah.
What he was stopped in one, it was a unanimous decision in the other. Now, I mean, Pavlik was was up there amongst the best. Couldn't anybody have lost to Pavlik? I mean, you know. When you look at Froch was right up there. He's not losing to journeymen. He's losing to great fighters.
He is losing to great fighters. Great fighters lose to great fighters all the time. I think what the tragedy of Jermaine Taylor was is that he seemed to be destined for huge things after the Hopkins fights, and it just never worked out for him. And there's no shame to losing to Kelly Pavlik. I mean, I wouldn't want to take a punch off Kelly Pavlik. But the first Kelly Pavlik result, and that's a hell of a fight. I mean, but people forget how good the first fight against Kelly Pavlik was. It was a barn burner. Jermaine Taylor put Kelly Pavlik down, I think, in the second round of that fight. And then Pavlik got up. I mean, it was a classic. But if you look at the fights before against Winky Wright and Kasim Umar and all these like 154 guys that were moving up to 160, Jermaine Taylor never looked great against any of them. He struggled against all of them. And then he loses, and then he seemed, you know, Karl Froch beats him in 12. Yeah. And that was a great performance by Taylor into the 12, because he put Karl Froch on the floor in the fourth or fifth round. And Karl Froch had an iron chin. And just as an aside, sorry, on Karl Froch, but I'll come back to the Jermaine Taylor point in a second. I would say Karl Froch probably has the best boxing career of any British fighter the last 25 or 26 years. In fact, I would even say Froch has had a better career than Joe Calzaghe. And I love Joe Calzaghe. I thought Joe Calzaghe was a better fighter. But if you look at Karl Froch from sort of Robin Reed onwards to the end of his career, I don't think anybody ever had a run of opponents like that.
Yeah, going back to Jermaine Taylor, the loss against Arthur Abraham should have been unexpected. You looked at him, and having known what we knew about Arthur Abraham, you thought that Taylor might be the one, but he didn't lose to a knockout in the 12th. And that night, they discover a brain bleed.
Yes, they do. And if you watch that knockout as well in the 12th against Arthur Abraham, when Taylor goes down, he's losing that fight on a split decision. And Arthur Abraham was, for what we said before about him, you know, essentially being a sparring partner who got lucky, he was a fairly good fighter. Like he was better of that lot that were coming through at the time in Germany. He was probably the best of them. But Taylor is losing a split decision, and he goes down in the 12th, and his head hits the floor of the ring, and you see his arms rise up by about 3 or 4 inches. And that's the sign of someone who's had a traumatic brain event. His body's going into spasm. So it's in the book. But I remember I was ringside that night at the Karl Froch-Andre Durrell fight in Nottingham, and they were showing it on the big screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody, I think it was Gareth Davies from The Guardian, turned around and said to me, he's not going to fight again. And unfortunately, Gareth was wrong on that, because Taylor does fight again. And my God, those results were ugly. And what came after that was ugly as well.
But he would look at that, and I know you say what you're saying here, and I wouldn't argue with any of those views, but he would say, or those that gave him the license would say, well, okay, we put him through medicals or whatever, and he came back and he won his last five fights, and in his final fight, he wins the IBF title against Sam Solomon. Mm-hmm. Of course, what we don't know is that what came after that was his life literally went into total collapse, really, didn't it? With the run-ins with the law and the mental health evaluations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, it's a very, very sad story what happens to him afterwards. You know, physically, yeah, he could have fought in those last five fights, but there's a certain point, and the body has this habit of not forgetting what you did to it. And I think I'm fairly on safe ground here, is that there are you can pass all the medical tests in the world, but boxing people, you know, coaches, managers, other fighters, are able to see before those tests can tell you that someone should not be fine. So if you go back to 1980, you had Muhammad Ali came out of retirement again, and he went to fight Larry Holmes, and he went to the Mayo Clinic, and the Mayo Clinic gave him what they said was a full medical evaluation, said, yeah, you can fight, it's fine. And everyone knew Ali shouldn't have had gloves on, he shouldn't even have been sparring in the gym. And he went in against Larry Holmes, and Holmes stopped him in, I think, 11 rounds. And it was sad, and yeah, but fight people knew he shouldn't have been fighting. And it was the same with Jermaine Taylor. Everyone could see really from, you know, maybe after the second Pavlik fight, certainly around about the time he was fighting guys like Jeff Lacy, that he was just, it was not going to end well. And the longer he was going to go on.
And I'll end with Wonka, the moral question. There is no good, safe way to enjoy boxing, not if you are a good person. So what are you saying then? Let's cut to the chase here. Everybody that watches boxing is a bad person?
No. Fundamentally, boxing is immoral. It just is. You're paying money to watch two people damage themselves. So to say, I you have to be a little bit, you'd be more of a hypocrite, I think, when you start turning around and saying, this person, I can't watch this person fight anymore, it's too damaged, because you have to take the rough with the smooth. You know, you signed up to watch these people damage themselves in their 20s, and then to look away piously when they start hitting 40, I think is hypocrisy. So there's no good way to do it. There's no, you can't sit there and pretend that these people aren't hurting each other. There are great people in boxing. Really, like the best people I've ever met were in boxing, and everyone I've spoken to for the book, it's been a pleasure to spend time. But let's not get past the fact that boxing itself is morally reprehensible.
Well, very strong views there from Pete Covell. And I know exactly what you're thinking. You're sat there now, aren't you, thinking, well, why wasn't the next question, well, what are you doing making a living in the sport then, if you have those views? And to be fair, we did actually continue talking for quite a while afterwards and had quite a good chat. But obviously, if we put in the entire conversation, the programs would run for hours and hours. The book, though, is worthy of reading, Death of a Boxer. As I said, it is no love letter to the sport, but it's interesting to read about areas of the sport that don't actually get written about that often. And that is it then for this edition of the show. Don't forget, you can listen into all of the previous editions of the Talking Sportsbook show on the website, www.talkingsportsbooks.com, or you can stream it from any streaming platform. And remember, if you like books, books on sport and sports books literature, then there is now a newly launched Facebook page. It's called Sports Books and Literature. What else? And is out now, so do head over there if you want to make a comment or you want to post any of your own stuff. I will be back in a few weeks' time with the next show. In the meantime, though, thank you very much for listening. From me, Tim Cable. Till next time, bye-bye for now.